Welcome to Thrivival 101, a fresh take on self-care for female mental health clinicians.
A podcast where we have the courage to talk about what actually supports and gets in the way of our self-care so that we can redefine what it truly means to take care of ourselves, our best tools, and thrive in this work. We are your hosts, Dr. Melissa Thiessen
and Dr. Karen Dick of Intentional Therapist. We're so happy to have you joining us today. Today, we are very pleased to be joined by Silvana Espinoza Lau. Silvana is an embodied liberation and decolonization consultant and coach for mental health professionals. Silvana coaches mental health professionals who want to incorporate decolonized, liberation-focused, and anti-oppressive values in their practices in an embodied way, and consults with mental health agencies that want to center therapy seekers with minoritized identities. Silvana is also an LMFT in private practice in the unceded Kalapuya territory in Oregon, and a clinical supervisor and consultant to both licensed and pre-licensed clinicians with a focus on anti-oppressive and decolonized practices. Thanks so much for being with us today, Silvana.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Yes, our pleasure. So something we're always trying to emphasize in our work is how our self-care is just greatly impacted by the messages we receive from our socialization and our training in the mental health field. And we'd certainly love to hear more about your thoughts on the impact of these scripts that we receive about professionalism, productivity, serving others, and other aspects of being a good therapist. Just love to hear your perspectives on that.
Yes, for sure. And I think that my perspective has the bias of my education. So my undergrad education is from back in my home country in Peru, and my graduate degree is from the US, from California. However, I think that we do have something in common, which is the fact that I think most of us clinicians have been trained in a Western model, right? A Western mm-hmm. model that prioritizes how we are professional, so that professionalism, the productivity, maybe our grades up to a certain extent as well, how we conduct ourselves, how many clients we see. Mm-hmm. So I think that what I have noticed in my personal experience and helping other clinicians is that one thing that we have in common, the script that we have in common, is this idea of I have to show up in a certain way that maybe fits who I am or maybe it doesn't, but I have to show up in this way. And there is an input of clients and there has to be an output of results. And the output maybe is an expectation of, I don't know, my productivity has to be 8 clients a day or 5 clients a day, depending on where you work, right? Or my productivity has to be a certain amount of hours a month or a certain amount of hours per quarter. But what if I cannot meet that productivity? And then I am starting to feel like there's something wrong with me, or I cannot meet the expectations. And I start to compare myself to my coworkers who are maybe on the surface meeting the expectations, but maybe are struggling. And then I have also these scripts about what self-care means, right? I have to, at least here in the US as a PTO, right? Your paid time off, you have to take, you know, you have your time off. So take it so that you can come back to work. But most of the times, the person that I'm working for, the agency that I'm working for, does not encourage other forms of self-care beyond don't come to work, right? And it's very individualized because it's up to me to be a quote unquote good clinician, to be a well-rested clinician, to be a productive clinician. So there's a lack of community as well, I think, in the scripts that at least I received, right? So just to speak about this in general terms is the idea of productivity, the idea of, you know, individualized treatment, the idea of how many hours I have to work and the idea of what self-care has to look like. And I think that that script of being a quote unquote good therapist is very, very unhealthy and very, very toxic, at least in my personal experience and in what I have seen, what I have witnessed from other coworkers. So that is, you know, in a general sense, how I see that we need to change those scripts as well.
Yeah, I think so much of what you said aligns with the messaging that we hope we're giving our listeners as well. And we've had a number of guests that we've interviewed who really talk about how that script didn't fit them. And they went through exactly what you're describing, right? Thinking either this the profession isn't for them, there's something wrong with them. And thankfully, the guests we've interviewed have found a way to kind of break through, break free from those scripts and develop a practice that actually fits very well with who they are and the amount of hours that they work that really allows them to show up in the best way that they can for their clients.
Yes, completely. And I think that that's something that I would add is that I am so happy that there are so many clinicians, so many mental health professionals out there that realize that these scripts don't work for them and that they don't have to follow those scripts. And the other layer of that is our identities, right? Because these scripts are very Western, are very European, white, able-bodied, centered. And not all of us fit that model, right? Even if you're white, it's different being a male than a female practitioner or a non-binary practitioner, you know? And let's just add the layer of being a practitioner of color or being a practitioner who's neurodivergent or LGBTQ from the LGBTQ plus community. So there are so many other identities that some of us have, and then we have to fit this model of being a quote unquote good therapist. So I am, yeah, it makes me happy that there are more and more clinicians that have realized that this doesn't work for them because it shouldn't. It doesn't work for everybody, and that's okay.
I feel like my neck is going to get sore from all the nodding I'm going to do during our conversation today, Silvana. I think so much of what you just said is so incredibly important. And I think we can even add to that list because Karen and I both have worked in the past and Karen still does primarily work in rural and northern settings. And that's another area where our traditional training models don't fully fit. And I think anytime we are sort of taking the traditional urban based, because most of the time that's what it is, right? Model as like, well, this is the only way that therapy can be done. And if you deviate at all from that, you're doing something wrong. Well, that's sending such a terrible message to people because that, of course, is not true at all. But it is a very pervasive message that is out there in our training. So, and I think this also is so important to be talking about because, of course, ironically, basically anybody who's trained as a therapist does talk therapy, right? And nonetheless, there are so many of these things that we don't talk about. And as you just said, though, thankfully, there are more people starting to talk about these things and question the way things have traditionally been done so that we can start to see some really important changes. But given that, unfortunately, there are still so many things that we're not talking enough about or not talking openly enough about, we'd love to hear some more of your thoughts, Silvana, about what do you think are some of those key topics that we just don't talk enough about yet, but we're starting to maybe make some inroads on.
I think that one of the things we don't talk much about, but I think we think about, is questioning the mental health model the way it is, right? The mental health system, the way that it exists. Every time that I meet with clinicians, we're all in agreement that the mental health model, at least here in the US, it's not working. Yes, it serves people, but it doesn't serve everybody. And then I wonder if I am here with a group of clinicians and we all agree on this, why are things not changing? And I think that's because, again, we live in a very individualistic society. So we know what community means, and maybe we don't have a community, and we don't have a community to question the system. Because again, I think that we were taught that since there are law and ethics in the profession, there is nothing wrong with the profession because we follow certain laws and we follow certain ethics. Therefore, everything is fine, right? And there, at least here in the US, there are boards and there are agencies that, you know, that they make sure that all clinicians are working, meeting certain requirements and following all those expectations. And if you don't, then you are going to experience certain consequences. Hopefully those are educational consequences, as a side note. But I think that we have received this idea of, yes, everything is right because there are laws and ethics. And we don't have enough community to question the model and to question how it's working for us and to question how it's working for our clients and to question how it's working for our own identities and to question how it's working for our clients' identities. And I believe that part of that is because we have been taught that we are these selfless individuals. We put our clients first, because we have learned this amazing skills and this amazing intervention, so we can help that other, that next person and the next, right? But I think that there's nothing wrong with putting myself first, because I am the instrument, I am the tool that is trying to support all of these people. So I need to think about myself and my community and whether the mental health model is working for me and for my community, whether that's the community of the people that I serve or the community of clinicians that I am working with, my peers, right? And I believe that we have, this is the last thing that I will say, that we have also lost, no, we haven't lost, we have forgotten our ability to imagine. Right? There's this concept that I like to use in my trainings, radical imagination. It's not my concept. Somebody else created this concept. But the idea of radical imagination is, can I think of a future that is different than the one that I am in? Right? And I see that as so intertwined with self-care, because I was taught that self-care is this, this, and that, ABC. But what if that doesn't work for me? Can't I imagine self-care as what really works for me? Can't I imagine mental health as what really works for myself and my community? And now that I have imagined it, maybe I can make that happen, or maybe I can plant that seed so that it happens in the next 10, 20, 30 years. I don't know. So there's a series of concepts that maybe on the surface are not so related to mental health as we know it. But I think those are the things that we don't talk about enough as mental health practitioners.
Yeah, I think you're so right about that, Silvana. And I know, you know, speaking on the work that Melissa and I have been doing around self-care specifically, I think that's one of the things we're really trying to focus on as well, kind of the absence of conversations about self-care. And unfortunately, some of the unhealthy systems that exist within healthcare that mental health clinicians are part of, and how can we start planting some seeds to change this so that there's a different reality for the clinicians that come after us. And I love that idea about kind of that radical imagination, and really just trying to taking the time and pausing and reflecting on how things could be. And I think you need that in order to even start thinking about, okay, what are some steps that we can start taking? And conversations, I think, are just always going to be an important part of that, and finding a community in which we feel safe to have some of those conversations.
Exactly. We cannot do this in isolation. I don't think anything can happen in isolation. So I need to start imagining something for that to become a reality. And I need a community of like-minded peers so that they can help me with this idea, right? As we know from therapy, or even from group therapy, right? If someone is having an experience, chances are somebody else within that group is having that experience. But we know from group therapy, we need validation. We need to be witnessed. And that's part of change, right? Even if it sounds so simple, someone to witness me, but it's an important part of this process of self-care, reimagining mental health so that it serves us and our communities.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to quickly emphasize to your point, Silvana, about kind of that really funny contradiction that is also in our training, but between be a blank slate, but also we are our best tool, right? So focus on, you know, being, you know, the relationship, the bond with our clients, but don't bring any of yourself to therapy because that's going to taint it, right? And what a contradiction, first of all, and also so unrealistic when we are talking about a profession that is built on essentially, right, the healing power of relationships, like you just said, being witnessed.
Yes.
I mean, goodness, my 7-year-old son immensely benefits from just having his feelings validated, right? So of course, the validation and witnessing that comes from that human connection is so important. And it is really completely ridiculous that so much of our training still emphasizes kind of not bringing any of ourselves to the therapy context. And it's just really a shame because, of course, we're not saying turn therapy into, you know, meetings with clients into your own therapy, but there's obviously ethical and effective ways to be ourselves that are actually going to make the therapy even more effective for our clients.
Yes. Yeah. Completely.
And we can do that and still be professional, because I think that's the other thing, right? This idea about what professionalism looks like is, again, I think it's often the image I have is kind of some of the founders of psychology, the white men, right? European influence. And I think unfortunately still there's some ideas that that's what professionalism looks like, and it can feel really stifling for folks who don't fit that mold in any way.
Completely. Who can be a, you know, to use this word, who can be a white European cishet able-bodied man, but a white European cishet able-bodied man, right? In my humble opinion, this idea of being a blank slate is so toxic and it's so unhealthy, but we can bring ourselves to this work that it's so intimate. It's a very intimate relationship that we have with our clients. But we can do it without centering ourselves, right? We can do it without that conversation, that session becoming our own therapy, of course. Mm-hmm. But how powerful for a person to see that their therapist is not this individual who has life figured out, who are perfect at coping with all of the stressors that they have, but someone who can tell them, yeah, that has happened to me too, and this is how I stand up after falling, or this is how I tend to my wounds after I am being hurt. And yes, it hurts, and these are the ways that have worked for me. What are the ways that can work for you, right? Let's figure that out. Let's collaborate, et cetera, et cetera. So there are ways. And the other piece that I want to add is that even if we tried, none of us can be a blank slate. One, if I put myself as an example, the moment you hear my accent, the moment you see my face, I cannot be a blank slate, and I don't want to be a blank slate, right? But then our clients, we have to give them credit. They do realize what's happening in the therapy room. When it's summer break and my schedule changes, even if I don't mention that I have a kid, they will know that I have a kid because my schedule will change to take care of said kid, right?
Absolutely.
Or so our clients are observant and they know what's happening for us. So there's no way that we can be blank slates, and we can still center them as we should and not center ourselves in the therapy room.
Yeah, I so agree. And, you know, for me, there's something to be said for being authentic. And again, right, I think there's ways we can be authentic in session in ways that are ethical and helpful. And because really, I think being a blank slate takes a lot of energy, and your energy is much better spent in the process, in the therapy process, than trying to manage all of these, I don't know, qualities about ourselves that in some way we're being told we shouldn't bring into the sessions.
Completely. I mean, talking about self-care, right? Why would I want to spend all my energy in trying to be something that I am not, or trying to hide things that maybe could benefit this therapeutic relationship? I'd rather spend my energy in things that are beneficial to my client and beneficial to myself and my community.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's certainly one thing to deal with the scripts that might come in our training as, you know, white women. But when we think about the more marginalized populations and how that group in particular might struggle with the imposter syndrome. And, you know, certainly there's some research that does support that more marginalized populations are more likely to have that experience. Be really interested in hearing your thoughts, Silvana, about how the oppressive system, such as the norms kind of inherent in the whole white supremacy culture, contribute to some of the experiences of imposter syndrome for marginalized as well as perhaps privileged, because I'm sure those are felt different, very differently.
Yeah, completely. I mean, yeah, if we could think of the identities that we hold, whether they are privileged identities, such as being white, such as being able-bodied, such as being living in a thin body, or being neurotypical, among other things, right? Of a certain educational level, socioeconomic level, right? So if we think of those privileged identities, yes, people who identify with those identities still experience imposter syndrome, because I think that the expectations that we have just in general in society are very unrealistic about how many hours we need to work, how we have to conduct ourselves, how we have to be professional, among other things, right? And if you want to marry and have kids, I just don't understand how are you supposed to work 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, and be expected to have so much energy for your kids, for your partner, and then have a social life, et cetera, right? So we feel like, what's wrong with me because I don't have enough energy, I don't have enough time. Well, the fact is that you don't have enough time because you're doing so much, right? So even if you have privileged identities, you may be experiencing some form of imposter syndrome. But yes, like you are saying, if we have some marginalized identities, then there are more layers of that imposter syndrome, right? There are, the first example that comes to my mind is individuals that I have worked with, both clients and clinicians, who have been raised at the border. And you can imagine any border, you know, in between two countries, with a certain set of cultural expectations and another set of cultural expectations, and feeling like you are neither from this place nor from the other place, right? So bring that to our capitalistic culture as a clinician, and you have someone that, if they don't have the right community, will always feel like they don't belong and that they are not doing things right, right? Or that they don't belong to the group of clinicians that they want to belong to. If you are a neurodivergent clinician and you're expected to work 8 hours a day and write your progress notes after every client in a certain way and include certain information, I know that my brain works differently and I can get things done, but I can get things done according to how my brain works and my nervous system works. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? So, but if we don't know that, then we are feeling like there is something wrong with ourselves, and like, I am not performing, I am not producing in the way that I am supposed to, because maybe I think that the rest of my peers are performing in that way, right? So those are just some examples. And then the oppressive systems are all of these systems, legislations, at a national level, at a state level, even within the mental health system, legislation and expectations that say that the mental health system or mental health has to be conducted in a certain way, right? Six sessions and that's it. Or 10 sessions and you have to, you're expected to have a certain improvement, a certain, you know, progress in therapy. What if that doesn't happen? Because that just doesn't work for me. You know, there are so many ways in which systems are very oppressive for us as clinicians, and they just contribute to burnout for clinicians, and they contribute to not true healing for our clients, right? Because our clients believe that, okay, after these six sessions, yes, I have some coping techniques, but I still feel like there's something there that should change, but I already went to therapy, so what's wrong with me? Right. So it's kind of like this cycle that doesn't help anyone really, the way that this oppressive system really get in the way of therapy, but by not centering identities that remain at the margin, right? If they were just curious about, okay, how do we make therapy more accessible to people of color, to people from a lower socioeconomic level, to people who are neurodivergent so that they don't have to mask, so that they don't have to come to the neurotypical side of things, right? Among other identities.
I think that's, again, so many important points you've made, Silvana. And one thing that just kind of stands out for me is some conversations that I've had with individuals who would identify as neurodiverse. And some of the messaging they've received about their suitability for the profession, I find very interesting. Because, like, what a harmful message to be sending. And I would like to believe that our profession would see the value of having a more diverse group of clinicians who bring different insights and ideas about what we can do to positively influence people's mental health and well-being. And what better a group than a diverse group?
Yes, lived experience is very important, right? How am I going to connect with you if I don't have a similar experience than yours? Again, that doesn't mean that I'm going to disclose all my lived experience, but that means that I am going to maybe have a better understanding of what's happening for you. And I am going to help you problem solve or help you heal in a way that really fits who you are. So yeah, I think that it's so important for the mental health field to be as diverse as possible, to be as inclusive as possible of all people with all of their different identities.
I think another thing that you alluded to when you were talking about imposter syndrome, specifically, Silvana, is I think the reality that, number one, of course, if we're having that experience of, right, I don't belong here, then, of course, that has an impact on how the individual is feeling in the moment, obviously, and in subsequent moments. But then it's also going to have an impact on self-care and how we're interacting with others around us, right? And of course, we might think that maybe shouldn't that be maybe motivating to, like, figure out how you can belong, or, you know, I don't know, study more to feel more competent. But of course, that's not how it works. And instead, what happens is it just causes people to withdraw more because they don't want to be found out as not belonging, right? So it has this huge impact on how people are taking care of themselves in their work, absolutely. So this really leads to our next question, which is, we'd love to hear more of your thoughts. And I think you've already really highlighted, I think, one of the key pieces of just having a community that you feel you truly do belong to. I think so incredibly important, but would just love to hear more about that and anything else that you think clinicians can do to help limit the impact of oppressive systems or feeling like they're perhaps different than this traditional training mold, how clinicians can really help limit the impact of those things on their self-care, and perhaps by extension, how those steps might even then benefit the services that they're providing to their clients.
Yeah, completely. I think that everything begins with having a relationship with myself, with being connected to myself, but for that connection to be an embodied connection, right? Again, I think that as clinicians, as therapists, we know what mindfulness is. We have gone to a training on mindfulness. We have taught that to our clients. Chances are, maybe some clinicians also practice meditation. And I think that the way that some of us have learned that idea of mindfulness and meditation is kind of like a checklist type of thing, right? What are my five senses? Am I present in the room? Can I sense what else is in the room? Good, I am done for the day. But when I talk about embodied connections and being in an embodied connection or relationship with myself, I am talking about, am I aware of how I am hurting, how I am being harmed, or how I am experiencing maybe joy or contentment on a day-to-day basis, right? What are my needs right now? Can I stop for 5 minutes in between sessions, or can I create that time for myself? And this is not selfish, right? Before starting my day, if I work for an agency, or at the end of the day, to really check in with myself and really have an idea of what I'm doing, right? And there is no right or wrong in this check-in. Even if on that day I feel like my boss, I don't know if I can swear in this show, but if my boss was a bad person, my boss was an asshole, what if that day I'm feeling like, you know, that doesn't mean necessarily, because I know that for us clinicians, we also have this idea of being compassionate with others and showing empathy. So, you know, maybe my boss was having a bad day, so maybe that's what's happening. So we tend to minimize things that are happening around us, right? But to me, there's so much power in really embodying our feelings and each and every thought that we are having throughout the day. So if I am really feeling in that moment that my boss was an asshole, maybe there's a message behind that. Maybe there's a message of, I am feeling angry. I am feeling like I was not heard. I am feeling like that decision was not fair, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a conversation that I can have with my boss the following day, whenever. But the only way that I get there to know what, the only way that I get to know what my needs are and what my boundaries are is to really spend time with myself, to really connect with what I'm feeling, what I'm experiencing, even things coming from my id, you know, those things that I would usually censor. No, this is your moment to not censor yourself, because here you are in relationship with yourself and checking in with yourself, right? And after having that embodied relationship with myself, how can I have community? How can I have other people that understand that this is not what I believe about my boss, to follow this example, but what is the meaning underneath this sentence, right? Having someone to vent with, man, I had a horrible day today, right? So having that witness again, that place to vent, that place to problem solve with others. So I think those are two things that we need, because then we are doing the job that we're asking our clients to do, right? And I think that there's no better way that teaching our clients, that modeling things for our clients, when we are really embodying those practices that we want our clients to practice, right? It's very easy for me to tell my clients to meditate or to practice mindfulness, but if I am not doing it myself, I am pretty sure that they can sense it. So if I am having this embodied relationship with myself, I am pretty sure that I can transmit that to my clients as well, right? And I am helping others being in connection with themselves, figuring out what their boundaries are, what their needs are, how to ask for those needs to be met, how to go out there and find their own communities. So again, I think that such a simple thing can have an amazing positive snowballing effect.
And I'm just reflecting on what you said earlier as well, Silvana, about when we have that community, not only is it that sense of belonging and the opportunity to be witnessed, but then it's also the support for questioning the status quo and basically the validation that it's okay to do that, it's possible to do that, that change can occur, even if it may be slow at times, but that that is something that is also worth putting our effort into. And I think, of course, all of that is going to be so much easier when we are starting from that place of understanding ourselves, understanding our own thoughts and feelings, understanding what's important to us. And then we'll know that, yeah, like you said, what kind of community is it that we want to be connecting with so that we can maybe achieve some of those greater goals for not only ourselves, but our colleagues and our profession at large. And not that that has to be our responsibility either. Like, it's okay if we don't have the bandwidth to do that. But I think it's just one of the beautiful things that becomes more possible when we are really grounded in ourselves and then connected to a community of like-minded colleagues.
Yeah, completely. It's kind of like a muscle that you start working, right? Kind of like, I don't know, going to the gym with a gym buddy. You have the motivation to do it and you start doing it because you really want to do it. So you're putting that into practice and it's so much easier to do it after a month, 2 months, a year, et cetera, et cetera. And something very important that you just said is, yeah, it's not our sole responsibility. It's up to how much bandwidth we have, right? And I think that that's also a very important piece of self-compassion and self-care as clinicians, right? I want to be aware of what my resources are, how much time, how much money, how much energy, how much bandwidth I have. Because if I have only 5 minutes, but I have just 10% of the energy that I usually have, maybe self-care right now looks like closing my door if I work for an agency, not answering phone calls, and that's it. And that's self-care in that moment, right? Maybe if my resources are money and time, I can take a vacation if that is what I really want. So, you know, again, the conversation here is, to me, is it is not my sole responsibility. It has to be the responsibility of the community, but it also depends on how many resources I have at a given time. And that will determine how I'm setting boundaries, how I'm asking for my needs to be met, and how I am engaging in my own self-care.
Absolutely. I know one of the things we talk about is self-care being very individualized and a dynamic process, right? Because I know even for me, what self-care looks like 1 week for me might be very different than what it looks like the next week for a lot of the same reasons that you're just describing, Silvana. And
yeah,
being able to be kind and compassionate with ourselves and just acknowledge what we are doing in an effort to take care of ourselves, I think is just so important as we go on all our individualized self-care journeys that that we have. So, Vanna, what's the most important takeaway that you hope someone listening today will remember from our conversation? That's a big question, right? Because there's a lot of really important messages in what we've been discussing today. But even if you can say a couple of takeaway messages that you really hope that people have.
Yeah, I think that all of things that we've been talking about that are very important for me, and that I think that, you know, if I want your listeners to get something out of this conversation is the importance of having a community and the importance of being in embodied connections, in embodied relationships. understanding that a community doesn't mean, you know, I need to have at least five buddies, five best friends. No, a community could be one other person. And my community can change as well. This is my community. Over here is my community of peers and colleagues. Over here is my community of the people who help me with my family and my raise my kid, et cetera, et cetera. Over there is a community of, you know, all the aspects of your life. And the fact that we need to exist in these communities in embodied relationships, in embodied connections. I really need to know what's happening with myself in order to be in relationship with others so that these relationships can be authentic, can be healthy. And if there is any form of rupture in these relationships, because again, we're imperfect human beings, we can go through repair, right? So those are the two things that, and how I would summarize what my goal is for clinicians and for clinicians' self-care, to have a community and to navigate these communities from a place of embodied connections.
I feel like that just so eloquently really emphasizes so much of our first pillar of self-care being connection. And I'm sure the wheels are turning in Karen's head as well about some things that we are maybe going to add into our connection pillar as a result of our discussion with you today, Silvana. Yeah, just we couldn't agree more with the importance of those points as well. So just before we get to our very final question, again, we've just so appreciated everything that you've shared and this perspective on self-care. So we would love for more people to connect with the work that you do. So where can they go to find out more?
Yeah, they can find me on my website, which is www.7thselfconsulting.com. They can also find me on Instagram. My handle is Decolonize Your Practice with a Z, Decolonize Your Practice. Facebook, same thing, Decolonize Your Practice. They can also find me there.
Thanks so much. And we always love trying to broaden our listeners' concepts about what self-care looks like. So one of the questions we always love to ask our guests is what your favorite kind of non-conventional self-care practice is. We'd really just love to hear your thoughts on that, Silvana.
Yeah, I have several non-conventional self-care strategies that are very simple, don't take a lot of time and don't take a lot of money. I like to sit on, there's a deck on my backyard, and I like to just see, there's a beautiful big tree that my neighbor has. So just being in nature, trying to connect with what's there. Again, I guess that's my way of doing practicing mindfulness, but just being there, feeling the sun if it's sunny, seeing that beautiful big tree and feeling the grass, that to me, it's a moment of self-care because it allows me to connect with how I'm feeling. And sometimes that's not happy because I also have my stressors, but that is amazing because, you know, if I realize in that moment that there are some dark places, some dark spaces within myself, that's the moment to get curious about those dark spaces and do something about them if I have the time and the bandwidth and those dark spaces once, you know, a visit for myself, if you will. So just something as simple as that is very, very useful for me. Spending time with my kid, spending time with the two cats that I have. So it's honestly, the very simple things that work for me, spending time with friends, it doesn't have to be, you know, every weekend going out. It's just a meeting, text conversation, but knowing that there's people out there, those are the things that help me a lot.
And those are, you know, so many of the things you mentioned, I also would say are parts of my self-care. And I think it is such an important message that they don't need to be these grand gestures. And in fact, I think we're going to get a lot further by incorporating the what might seem like simpler parts of self-care, just some opportunities to reconnect and check in with ourselves. And what better way to do that than, honestly, I totally agree with you, Silvana, than to do that when you're connecting with nature as well. So I know for me, even if I'm having a rough day and there are some dark spaces that are coming up for me, somehow just being in nature lightens them, even just a little, just from allowing that space and time in nature for me. So thanks so much for sharing those with us, Silvana.
Yeah, for sure. And don't get me wrong, like if again, it's thinking of resources, if I have money and time, I will rent a fancy Airbnb. If I can take a trip elsewhere, I will do that. But what's the point of taking a trip and spending all that money if I am not in connection with myself and if I am not checking in with myself and with the people that I'm traveling with, right? So again, it simple works for me. It doesn't have to be simple all the time, but it is simple because I am checking in with myself in that moment and I know that I want simple in that moment. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Such a good point. We don't want to encourage. I think some people, their self-care is the big vacation once a year.
Maybe, yeah.
And you know what's, I mean, I can appreciate that. I love traveling as well, but I think sometimes it's a bit of a sad state where, right, that's your only self-care. You're kind of
Yes.
just trudging through the trenches for the rest of the year, and then there's this vacation, and then you go back, and nothing else has changed. And you're really
Completely.
not taking the time to connect with yourself
Exactly.
and really create a life worth living. So,
Exactly. Yes.
well, Savannah, once again, Melissa and I just are so appreciative that you took the time with us today to talk about such an important topic. And again, hopefully our listeners will follow you and visit you on your website to learn more about everything that you offer.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And yes, I would be delighted to work with more people on decolonizing their practices, decolonizing themselves, decolonizing their communities. And yeah, this was a great conversation. So thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
And thank you for joining us as well.
If you would like to learn more about how you can thrive in your work as a female mental health clinician, please visit us online at intentionaltherapist.ca, where you can discover more resources, read about our 4Cs framework, and sign up for our free newsletter.
We look forward to connecting with you there and creating a courageous community of like-minded women.